Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's taking the week off, but check in with us next time and she'll be back. So, this week we have a really interesting true crime slash memoir written by Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan. And the title is The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. Liza Rodman attended the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and received her Bachelor of Arts with a concentration in creative writing from Vermont College. She and her husband live outside Boston and have three children and five grandchildren. The Babysitter is her first book. Jennifer Jordan is an award-winning author, filmmaker, and screenwriter with decades of experience as a news anchor and investigative journalist. In addition to her own books, Savage Summit and The Last Man on the Mountain, she has ghostwritten two other books, so that makes The Babysitter her fifth book. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Liza and Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Monica.
And am I pronouncing your names correctly?
You are.
All right.
Mine's pretty easy.
Yes, it is. So tell me how the two of you came to write this book together.
Do you want me to tell the story, Liza?
Yes, I think you should.
We met in college, and we met on an August day when I was brewing a pot of coffee, which I am wont to do because I never trust the coffee where I travel, especially beginning way back in college. So I was brewing a pot of coffee, and through the door came a coffee mug and then pretty Liza's face asking for a cup of coffee. And so we bonded over that first pot of coffee, and we've been best of friends ever since, and spent weekends during college hitchhiking to my father in Vermont and her mother, the famous Betty, in Boston, and we worked a summer together on the coast of Oregon. And so it's been a long and fascinating journey, and here we are.
And were you both wanting to become authors from that very beginning?
I certainly I majored in journalism and Middle East history. I actually wanted to be a Middle East correspondent, but then the Middle East blew up by the time I had my degree. And so I've always written, and I've always wanted to write, and journalism was my first path. And then in the course of the journalism, I started writing magazine articles when I was living in Boston. And through one of those magazine articles, found the subject of my first book. And as petrified as I was with writing that first book, a very dear friend and a very sage writer said to me, don't think about it being a book. Think about writing 15 different articles and putting them together. It's like, oh, I can do that. I've written 15 articles. So it was a great, because I think a lot of would-be book writers just get overwhelmed by the task of, a book with 80 to 100,000 words. But if you cut it down into article length of 5 to 10,000 words a piece, it's like, ah, easy peasy, I can do that. Well, not easy peasy, I'm exaggerating, but yeah.
Well, how about you, Liza? What was your journey to being a writer?
Oh, my journey is a long one. Excuse me. But I wrote my first book when I was 10 years old. You'll read about that in the book. 100 pages. And after that, I wrote two really bad collections of poetry when I was about 21. And after that, I sort of drifted into the theater. I worked a lot in the theater, but always writing and always journaling and always, circling back to my childhood, always writing or trying to write around my childhood, but never really having the time. Then I had stepchildren, then a child of my own, and everybody was young and needed me. So I spent most of that time raising kids and working as a tax accountant, but always sort of dabbling in it, and always got serious about it again about when my children started to go to college, and joined a women's writers group here in Boston, and always talking to Jen about it. We always talked about our stories. We always shared what we were writing. And then, I don't know, as I was telling Jen about this story, she said to me one day, "That's your book. That's your book." And so we went back and forth for a number of years, and she named it The Babysitter. And she kept saying to me, "What are you doing on The Babysitter?" And I said, "Nothing. I don't want to talk about it. I can't write about it." And she kept asking, God love her. And so then one day she called me and she said in 2018, "What are you doing on The Babysitter?" And I said, "It's in a drawer somewhere." Because I had sat down and wrote the first draft in 2014. And, you know, as I look back on that, realized that every book I've ever wanted to write is included in that first draft. So she said to me in 2018, "I'm between projects. What do you say about us collaborating and getting this book out into the world?" And as she tells it, better than I do, really, I cried, which is what I do, and said I never would have occurred to me to ask. And so here we are.
Wow. So Jennifer, did you not know about this kind of family history of Liza's before that?
No, I did not know. She did not know until 2005. And I knew her mother was a piece of work because I'd met her mother, but I did not know of her being babysat by a serial killer. And I didn't know that because, as I said, she didn't know it until 2005. And then once she realized it and shared the story with me, that's the point at which I said, "Well, by God, there's your book." And not only is it a book, it's a bestseller, The Babysitter.
Wow. So, Liza, tell us the kind of the gist of the story.
The gist of the story is that my mom was a single mom and divorced in 1963 and a Catholic. So she was excommunicated, and she was a school teacher, so she worked during the year, and she was a go-getter. So she was always looking for ways to make money. And my aunt, her best friend, who's not truly my aunt, but her best friend, she and her husband built this big sparkling motel on the bay down in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And when they did, they asked my mother to come down and work with them for the summer. And that was the summer of 1966. And so, of course, we went with her. And we had a series of babysitters, and each one worse than the next, but Tony Costa and his mother, Cecilia, were both hired at the motel. First his mother, who worked with my mother, and then Tony. And so that's how we met him, and that's how we ended up. He was hired as, you know, to do trash runs and to fix lamps and to, you know, sweep the driveway or whatever it was they needed done, he would do. But mostly he took trash runs, because when you have a big motel like that, you've got a lot of trash. So that's how we met Tony, and that is how we ended up in his care. And my aunt tells a wonderful story about standing at the front desk of the Royal Coachman, and there was quite a long driveway leading down to Route 6A, and she would say, she'd see him coming up the driveway, and she'd yell out to us, "Here comes Tony." And we'd all get on our flip-flops and our towels and run for the truck and beg to go.
My heart's going out to young Liza, who's really not got a very happy situation in life. And here's this man who seems to be very charming and sweet and pays attention to her and is kind. But didn't anybody in your life, like, think it was weird that he was hanging out with he had kids of his own that weren't even around, but he was hanging out with these other kids and taking you places?
I guess the answer to that is no. You'd have to ask them. I think it was more of a type of a thing where he was like a cousin. That's how I describe him. He was like that cool cousin with the cool bell bottoms that you wanted to be and that you wanted to hang around with. Don't forget, his mother worked there. And his mother was relatively close to both my aunt and my mother. And she was, you know, closer to their age. She was a mother figure to them, I think. And so to have him hanging around, it was like a cousin or an older brother. And they were always, remember, they were maybe 30, 32. So they were always looking, you know, they called my mother the babysitter finder. And so drop of a hat, if you need a babysitter, call Betty. She'll get you a babysitter. And she was less than discerning about who she picked. So it was more like he was the older brother or the older cousin, and he'd take us off their hands. And that to them was worth it. So nobody thought it was the least bit strange.
Wow. And another reason nobody thought it was strange is, you know, you've got to think about it in the context of Provincetown in the mid to late 1960s. It was, as Norman Mailer called it, the Wild West of the East Coast. And so there were just a lot of vagrants and hippies, and, you know, the gay liberation had just really hit the scene. And so there were a lot of characters. And the fact that Tony was, well, not what you might call reliable and not what you might call necessarily balanced. He was at least, you know, he showed up and was friendly and gentle and kind to Liza and her sister and her cousins. So it was, you know, he kind of blended in with this crazy scene going on and wasn't the least bit noticed for, shall we call them, his vagaries. He was able to kind of, you know, sin in plain sight, like the rest of the community was doing at the time.
Well, and there were lots of workers at the hotel, too, and he was among them. And they were all young guys, college-age guys, some high school-age guys, and women. So it was a teenage scene, if you will. And Tony was known in town, and a lot of the people who worked there were from town. So they all kind of knew each other. And I remember one of the comments I got during one of my interviews with someone else who was there at the time said, you know, everyone thought he was a great guy, and we put that in the book, and he was. And so he sort of melded in with this coterie of young people who were all working at the motel at the time. So it just wasn't that unusual.
Wow. And, of course, you never suspected anything at
the
time.
Oh, no. No, not at the time. Uh-uh.
So how did you find out that Tony was a serial killer?
Well, I during the time we were in Provincetown, we knew something had happened. But we weren't privy. And, you know, sometimes looking back, I wonder if I really ever connected. You know, Cecilia was Cecilia Bonaviri because she was remarried. So she didn't even have the same last name as Tony. And so we just knew him as Tony. So what ended up happening to me was, as I went back to school to finish my bachelor's degree when I was in my early 40s, and I started having these incredible nightmares, and they were all fairly similar. I started writing them down almost immediately because they were so troubling and violent, and there was always this man with this anonymous face. And so as I'm writing them down over a course of about 6 months, they're becoming part of my thesis for my undergraduate degree and part of my process journal, if you will. So one night I had this dream, nightmare, where there was Tony and there was his face. And it was the first time I saw a man's face in the dream. And he backed me up against the wall in the motel, and I was in my little 9-year-old girl spaghetti strap nightgown. And he backed me up against the wall and put a gun to my head. And when I woke up, I was traumatized. And so at that point, I decided, when I got home, I was actually in the dorm when I had the dream, and I decided I'd better start asking some questions. And so my mother and aunt came for dinner shortly thereafter, and I said, is there something that happened that you're not telling me? Is there something that happened to me? And because I'm having these dreams about, and here's Tony Costa in my dream. Why am I dreaming about Tony Costa? And that's the point at which you'll hear in the prologue that my mother says to me, well, I know he became a serial killer. Like, I know he became a dentist.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was just a moment in time where everything slowed down. And I think, you know, all writers or many writers will tell you and have told you that they become obsessed with something and can't let it go. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
It sort of took hold of me.
I can understand why, because I would imagine that because of everything else that was going on in your life at that point, at that time, and how, like I said, how really you were in an abusive situation, that maybe that wasn't something you wanted to spend a lot of time thinking about up till that point.
Right.
And,
right. I mean, I spent a lot of time writing about those stories during, you know, the trajectory of my life, you know, placing them in different spots. But I did write those stories over and over again. So when it came time to put them in the book, thank God for Jennifer, because she guided me through that, you know.
Now, the book, The Babysitter, is partly your memoir and talks about your summers in Provincetown and your relationship with your mother and with your non-relationship with your father and your relationship with Tony. But there's also a whole sort of investigative part of the book where you're investigating Tony's life and what was going on. So is that something like that you, the two of you did together, or did you split up parts of and say, okay, you do this part, I'll do this part?
Well, I started researching in 2005 when I first had that conversation with my mother. So, and in a really obsessive way. So I did a lot of research leading and a lot of talking to a lot of people, including Jen, during those years from 2005 to 2018. And then when Jen came on board, we sort of initially, I mean, it was a true collaboration in so much as sometimes we were, as she puts it, shoulder to shoulder or word choice to word choice. And sometimes we went off to our corners, and she worked on the investigative pieces, or would edit the memoir pieces. So, but I mean, it was so difficult for me to find a structure of that book that would work, and to find a way to put it into words that, and I say this a lot, and I mean it. This book needed two writers, because the investigative pieces that Jen so beautifully laid out and the structure of the Liza Tony, Liza Tony, Liza Tony chapters was what it needed. And she almost knew that instinctively walking in. Oh, I know what this needs. You know how that is. Sometimes you're too close to something. And so I think in a lot of ways my struggle had to do with how close I was to it. Jen, you might have something to say about the way we handled that, too.
Right, and it's the structure of going back and forth between voices, and really back and forth between genres, between memoir and true crime, was something that even our agent was skeptical of and said, really? I mean, you know, you have to choose a voice. And I said, no, I can do it, because having been a ghostwriter on my two previous books to this one, you know, I have learned that, especially in one I wrote with one of the Boston Marathon bombing survivors, it needed all of the four voices involved in her, in the bombing. And so I knew that I could go from voice to voice to voice and do it seamlessly. And so when Liza and I started talking about this structure and discussing, well, okay, am I going to help you write your memoir, or are you going to help me fill in the pieces of the investigation, and it will be kind of your story written by me, or how we're going to do this? And I said, no. We have to do it in both voices. And with Liza had already done by this point just a Herculean amount of research, so that by the time I came to the story, I really dove into her work and laid out literally on the floor the structure with the material, with what she had drafted in memoir and what she had gathered in research, And then, as she said, we worked sometimes cheek to jowl and sometimes in our own little corners for days at a time. And then we would come together and usually in beautiful houses on the East Coast. I don't know how we managed that one, but we did. And work together. And sometimes, you know, deep into the night. So it really has been, it's been a fascinating and really wonderful and lovely time, because with in all the books I've written and in the two that I've ghosted, I've never done it with one of my dear friends. So to spend the kind of quality time that she and I have has been just a gift. And to,
it's been pretty, you know, remarkable.
To work the story together into what is rapidly becoming a bestseller is just, of course, magic for any writer. And to have it, you know, to have it work out this way has been really just a huge gift.
Wow, that's so cool. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are co-authors Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan, authors of The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. Now, your mother and your auntie don't come off looking too great in this book, I must say. Are they, you know, what kind of response are you getting from family members? And
yeah,
other
interesting.
People who are in the book.
Two things. I think you have to contextualize it further with both of them, because they were both young. They were both, that's the way it was then. You know, things, we had an enormous amount of freedom as kids. And, you know, when they did try and find us a babysitter, they didn't do such a great job. So, and my mother, you know, Jen and I have gone back and forth. You know, in the beginning, I was almost like Patty Hearst with a little Stockholm syndrome, trying to describe what happened with my mother and how it felt. With family members, I'm getting, I'm sure I'm getting polite responses. I'm getting enthusiastic responses. I'm getting, I wish I could have helped responses I didn't know. You'd be amazed how many people who were actually there with me and had the same experience I had at different times, didn't understand what was going on, because, of course, they were living their own child life. And in the beginning of the book, I think we say this about other people seeing things quite differently. You know, my sister, for instance, and she's a really good example, really doesn't want to go there. She doesn't want to delve into all this. And she's gone so far as to describe me as the rememberer and her as the forgetter for reasons that are very personal and for and that I have to respect, and so doesn't she, or so does she. So I really mixed reactions, but mostly very warm reactions. And, you know, I didn't put anything in the book that I couldn't corroborate, that I didn't say to someone, do you remember this? And she'd say, or he'd say, yes, but I remember this too, or I remember it in a different way. Or, you know, we talked a lot about Cecilia's sweater in the, both in the book and in our, all of our lives. So while it was a very wild time and a very rough time for me, It was less of a less so for other people, and surprised people. And I that's not really a surprise to me.
Mm. Well, it's I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, well, does that make it better or make it worse that people
in what
were,
way?
Well, the fact that other kids not seeing. That's completely understandable, because children are going to have a very limited perspective, but other adults in your life really not seeing what was going on, that there was nobody there to protect you, and and nobody claiming, and I'm not talking about protecting you from Tony. I'm talking about you protecting you from everything that was happening.
Right.
And because, you know, Tony obviously was a he must have been very charming and
he was
very convincing that he was, you know, that it was hard to see. It's not like, you know, he had serial killer written across his forehead.
You know? Precisely.
So I can,
and, you
I
know,
can
he didn't even need to be
that.
Convincing. Yeah.
Oh, follow up on that.
Well, what I mean by that is that he was sort of part of a he fit the narrative, didn't he? Because he was there and said, oh, I'll take them off your hands. So he really didn't even need to be convincing. His mother was in the mix. And all she did was gush over him. And all she did was say, my Tony, my Tony, my Tony. He was handsome. He was strong. He could fix anything. So he didn't really need to be convincing in terms of, you know, convince me you're not dangerous. Because nobody looked for danger. Nobody looked.
And he was a father of three. And
right.
You know, he was a married man. Everybody knew everybody's family. So it wasn't like some stranger getting off the bus from Boston and saying, can I babysit your kids? I mean, it was, you know, he was part of the community.
Right.
Everybody
so
I can
understand that, you know, that your mother didn't suspect him, you know, that there was something wrong with him. Although, I got to say, marrying a 13-year-old pregnant, which he did with his wife, marrying her at 14, I mean, that's just not right.
It's not right, and it's unclear to me who knew what about that. It makes sense that that would not be common knowledge amongst my mother and my aunt, but I don't know for sure. And, you know, it's a funny thing. I never asked that question. And they've both passed away, so now I can't ask the question.
Oh.
But I know that, you know, he was arrested afterward. So he was arrested in 1969 and just never showed up again. And that's the other thing, is that this was during the summers. So we had 9 months of the year where there was no Tony and Cecilia. So when everybody went to Provincetown for the summer, everybody wanted to have a good time. And I really believe that they thought we were off having a good time. And you know what? We were.
Mm-hmm.
So the serial killer thing, if you think about it, there was no term for serial killer. It was never coined until the 1970s, until the FBI formed their behavioral science unit. And so there wasn't really a word for what Tony did, and who would actually think of such a thing? It just wasn't on anyone's radar. It was on from a childhood perspective, I think, you know, there's always that creepy guy in your neighborhood, no matter what decade you grew up. But Tony wasn't that guy.
No.
He wasn't that guy.
Well, that was what I meant, you know, him being very charming.
Mm-hmm.
He managed to convince an awful lot of young women to go places alone with him and, you know, put themselves at risk, basically, without ever being suspected of anything. How was he able to just do all of this in plain sight?
I think part of it was the fact, again, is the context of the time and the fact that a lot of these kids are from troubled families, as was I and as was Tony. So I think kids like that kind of bond together with those kinds of backgrounds. So I think that's one big thing. And Jen,
and three of
you have.
Yeah, three of his five victims that we know of. Three of those five victims, as Liza was saying, had troubled backgrounds, had pretty serious drug issues, and they all at one point had a sexual relationship with him. So, of course, they were going to the woods with him. Of course, they were going, you know, off in his car for hours on end. I mean, they didn't question it because it was the times and everybody was kind of, you know, let it all hang out. Everybody was getting high. Everybody was getting drunk. Everybody was, not accountable. And for these three young women, you know, teenagers really, there was nobody checking. I mean, you know, the mothers weren't on the front doorstep ringing the dinner bell. This was not,
right.
You know, these were not girls from happy homes where the family gathered to tell their, you know, what happened in school that day around the dinner table.
So until the last really, two victims.
Right, exactly. That's why I say three of the five. Because, you know, those three, when they disappeared, they were like, well, two that disappeared. One was found dead. But they were kind of lost in the ether. I mean, one of the girls, Susan Perry's mother, didn't even report her missing until a body had been found months later. And when asked by the police, why haven't you reported her missing until now? She goes, yeah, well, you know, kids these days. So that was.
And that was real.
Yeah, and that's a quote in the book because it's a quote in the police record. Yeah, you know, kids these days. So, you know, and she was one of the mothers that wasn't ringing that dinner bell. So, yeah, I mean, women, it wasn't so much an issue of trust and trusting Tony and getting in his car. It was that he was a handsome, charismatic man, and they wanted to get in his car.
Mm-hmm.
So the last two, Pat and Marianne, did have families who cared.
You bet.
And they made a difference, didn't it? You know, how long might this have gone on if he had continued to only kill runaways, basically?
Right. And it's not only that Pat and Marianne were grown women with jobs and, you know, and loving, caring families. It was the fact that, I just totally lost my train of thought.
I think you're going with the VW.
I am. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Tony, for all we know, Tony would still be out there killing, but he made one huge mistake that eventually got him caught. And that was greed. And that was taking his last two victims' car and thinking he could get away with it. So by the time they caught up with him, caught up with the car, caught up with what the hell, Tony, why do you have these two women's car? Then he started weaving this web of lies and, you know, lies to undo the lies before and then more lies to cover for those lies. And he just tripped himself up in not
right.
being
Right. He was
able
sort of
to...
spiraling at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
He was spiraling. So, yeah, I mean, to answer your question, Monica, it certainly wasn't the Keystone Cops who caught him. It was Tony getting greedy with having that his victim. Shiny new VW Beetle sitting out there in the woods and thinking, oh gosh, I mean, why have a good car go to waste? That finally got him.
And, you know, when women went missing during that time. When they interviewed, one of the interviews that the police did with Tony, they sat him there for 6 hours. And as part of that interview, they read off a list of missing women's names that was 60 women deep.
Oh, 60, yeah.
Yeah. And
so
have you seen this one?
He was convicted of five murders?
Two.
But he was – so was he never tried for any of the others?
That's right.
No, because the police
to.
Knew they had – as they said, and we haven't quoted in the book, you know, how many life sentences can one man serve? So they knew they had him dead to rights on the last two. So that they didn't need to try him on anymore.
Okay, but he's known to have killed five, but is it possible that there were more?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Because as Elijah said, there were 60 missing women right in that area of the time, but there were 5,000 in New England in that same time frame of missing women, most of whom have either showed up or been found to be, you know, not missing. But there are some on that list that just never, they really never knew what happened to them. And now 50 years later, they'll never know. But
right.
It was, you know, his own defense attorneys suspected him of upwards of 8. Well, 13, but we found that 3 were not in that docket.
Yeah, tell us a little more about that. I found that really interesting that, like, the investigators at the time couldn't find these women, but all these years later, you could.
Well, do you want me to read from the book? Because that was my chosen reading. Okay, this is
absolutely
toward the end of the book. So, and finally, there were the women who disappeared and were presumed to be among those he killed: Diane Fedoroff, Bonnie Williams, and Barbara Spalding. In writing about these three women, we were unwilling to cut and paste from previous chroniclers' accounts the sentence, quote, "She was never seen alive again," close quote, since we didn't know for a fact that it was true. We asked ourselves, what might have happened in 1969 when police, investigating other suspected victims of Tony Costa, knocked at the door of Spalding's commune in Haight-Ashbury, looking for a woman and a drug addict who was already known to the welfare department and the city's emergency rooms? Our guess was that the men in blue uniforms carrying guns on their hips were stonewalled by Barbara's commune mates, if in fact the door was even opened. So 50 years later, we did our own investigation. With a combination of databases, we cross-referenced every possible Barbara, Diane, and Bonnie until we had a short list of women and their relatives, and then began writing and calling. And nearly after a year, we found out what happened to each of them and have been able to tell, to correct decades of erroneous chronicling of their murders. And so while we know Tony Costa killed five, and according to police, as well as his own defense team, was suspected in the disappearances of several more, 50 years after the fact, we now know that Bonnie, Diane, and Barbara weren't among them. Some mysteries do get solved. When the siblings and children of these three women discovered that their loved ones had been reported as missing 50 years ago and were assumed murdered by Tony Costa, a serial killer, they were all understandably shocked. While the women died too young, Diane at age 45 in 1995, Barbara at 50 in 1999, and Bonnie at 62 in 2010, they didn't mysteriously vanish. They went on to marry, have children who love and miss them, and lived their lives for years after their encounter with Tony Costa. Bonnie Williams' sister shared a wonderful musing of what Bonnie's reaction might have been upon hearing the news of her presumed murder 50 years before. Quote, "I can picture Bonnie sitting there with a scotch in one hand, a cigarette in her other, slapping her leg and laughing hysterically, saying, 'You mean that wuss from Provincetown was a serial killer? No way. I could have taken him down with one arm behind my back.' Oh, that Bonnie had had the chance to stop the serial killer." And that's the last line of the book.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, her sister, I sent that sister a copy of the book. And she just today, while we were waiting for your call, emailed me and did a screenshot of that last page and said, "Oh, my God, I love this."
Oh.
So it was a wonderful moment to connect with those. With the sisters and the daughters of these three women who had no idea how history had recorded their loved one.
Wow. Now, have a lot of people written about Tony Costa? Because he's not someone that I was familiar with. He's not like Son of Sam or, one that I was really, that I've heard a lot about.
Right. No, they haven't. One book was published 40 years ago. That was much more a book about the case and the trial and the murders themselves. So Tony wrote a manuscript that was never published, and because it really is just a horrific piece of work. And then another writer, and we had all of his records, which were so invaluable, did exhaustive interviews with Tony, many of which were on tape, which we have. But that book was also refused out of hand, and not published. So we have two unpublished manuscripts and one that was published 40 years ago. But that's it. He was headline news at the time, but not since.
And how are you able to get all that material?
Liza?
I started with trying to get the trial transcript from the state of Massachusetts. And discovered, I waited 3 months. That was my first piece of research. And I waited 3 months, and 3 months went by, and they emailed me and said, "You know, we can't find it." So I said, "Well, I'm going to have to go another avenue." And then I discovered that the man who had written the exhaustive account of the case in 1981 had passed away and left all of his records to Kent State University, so that they were in the special archives. So I went there just to check it out. And what I discovered was boxes and boxes and boxes of evidence from the trial. I discovered the missing trial transcript from the state of Massachusetts. I discovered what was inside the glove box of Pat Walsh's VW and the dentine gum that still smelled. And 10,000 pages of police interviews, as Jen said, taped interviews that were falling apart in my hands. They were cassettes, and they were just disintegrating, which I then had digitized for posterity. I discovered Tony's personal effects. So I had so much research, I didn't know what to do with it. And it took me many times going back and forth to Kent State to go through what I had discovered there. And basically, in part, what Leo DeMore was his name, the man who wrote that book in 1981, and he had a good relationship with the police. He was an old newspaper man on the Cape. So he had a good relationship with the police, and they signed over boxes of evidence.
Now, is that allowed
today? No,
I was gonna say.
I don't think so. Not anymore. But again, it's a good. It goes to the point that Norman Mailer made, which was it was like the Wild West, and it was.
Mm.
So no, it's not allowed. Most of what happened then isn't allowed anymore.
So this guy, was that the book that did get published or that did not get published?
That did get published.
Why? Mm-hmm. I wonder why he was so, you know, because it sounds like he spent a lot of time and energy and effort on that. You know,
he did. I read one quote from Leo that I wished he probably wished he'd never said, which was that he related to Costa. And in some odd way that he really didn't describe very well. Sometimes, as you know, writers get obsessed. And I think he was interested. He had he wrote also about the Kennedy, about Mary Jo Kopechne and Ted Kennedy, a very famous book called Senatorial Privilege. And so he was somebody from the area. He had lived in Provincetown, so he knew the area. He knew the murders inside and out. I think he was there when it happened. Mm. And so that kind of thing will stick with you when you're a writer. He may have even covered it for the paper. I don't know.
So he definitely had some connection, but not quite as much as you did.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
So when you were going through all of that evidence, it must have been overwhelming to know what to pay attention to.
That's funny. Yeah, that's such a good question, too, because I had to pay attention to all of it.
Mm.
Every single thing. And
were you able to make copies of everything, or did you have to make notes, or how did you accumulate?
I did both. And as I got to know the archivists there, they were more lenient with me in terms of whether they would send me things or not. Initially, they won't do that. They really need to know you're serious. They really need to know you and know who you are. And they take that very seriously. So I'm sorry, I was just distracted. I have two big deers coming up my lawn. My husband took me back over and over again because I really couldn't go back there alone. Because what I was finding out was, as I was looking for myself in these papers, I was finding someone who I really didn't know, but I did. And so I would lay in my hotel room at night and stare up at the ceiling and say, you know, why is this happening to me exactly? Why can't I let this go? And so it started out as a personal excavation, and then when I realized I couldn't let it go, I describe it as going down the rabbit hole and then seeing there was so much there, I just never came up again. And I think it led me to this book.
Was there something that you found there that totally surprised you, that was like, or yeah. was like, okay, this is now this makes sense. This, you know, this is the key, the clue that I was looking for.
There were several things. There was a description. So I went to the fourth grade at the beginning of fourth grade in Provincetown. And during that time, there was someone had called in a bomb scare, which were big in those days, or starting to be big anyway. And I was there that day. I was in the school that day. And when I read that, I thought, wow, here I am. I was looking for myself in this research, and here I am. And then Tony, I found when Tony's personal effects, there was a leather bracelet that was deeply familiar to me, and his sunglasses, which were prescription because he had terrible vision. And of course, when you're driving kids around in a truck in the summertime, you're wearing sunglasses all the time. So there's a note that gets written that Tony writes and puts on that VW in the woods that says out of gas to try and distract the police or whoever was going through the woods that day and saw the car. And he wrote it with a red magic marker, and the magic marker was in the things that I found. And it still writes. So those kinds of things will stay with me forever.
Mm. So what happened to Tony Costa in the end?
What the official report was that he was found dead in his cell. He was convicted in 1970, and in 1974, he was found hanging in his cell. And the official report was by suicide. And yet, 6 months before Tony was found dead in his cell, the Boston Strangler was found dead in his in the same prison, and we think in the same cell block. And I have always maintained that megalomaniacs do not commit suicide because they're so righteous. And Tony always thought he was going to get a new legal team. They were going to get him out. He was going to walk the streets of Provincetown and go into his favorite pharmacy for a cup of tea and his Lorna Doone cookies. He had convinced himself, not so much of his innocence, but that he was righteous in what he did. And so I don't think that's the profile of a suicide. I think that's the profile of somebody who was killed in prison. And he was a pontificator, and you could just see how annoying he must have been to the fellow prisoners in, you know, preaching the gospel and practically calling himself the Son of God. And
right, he found really Jesus, that's right.
Right, proselytizing and lecturing about the evils of drug abuse. And you could just see them saying, oh, just shut the hell up. And he also, I mean, there were also rumors of possible drug connections. We don't know. We will never know. But
did he ever confess to the crimes?
He did.
He confessed, but immediately retracted it. Yes, he confessed,
but immediately he did it on tape. He did it during a polygraph.
Right, right, wow. Right. But then immediately said, no, I was under duress. I didn't do it. And if I was there, you know, my friend did it. And, you know, if I helped my friend, well, yeah, it was that kind of thing. It was just
his imaginary friend.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
No, he had a lot of those guys. Yeah. And they were all guilty of murder, but not he. Although he witnessed them.
Wow.
And the more he talked himself into these circles, the more it became blatantly, painfully clear that his knowledge of the crime was only possible by somebody not only there, but somebody holding the knife because of his descriptions of it. So, yeah, he was a talker, and I can only imagine that in prison it got to be a little bit too much for the inmates.
Well, before we run out of time, I think we'd like to hear a little more from the book.
Oh, great. I was going to, so as you know, the book is broken down into alternating chapters between Lies of the Child and the investigative omniscient narrator telling you about Tony, so I thought I'd read the prologue.
Great.
Liza's Nightmare, 2005. Close your eyes and count to four, he whispered. I felt his breath on my cheek. The barrel of the gun was hard and cold against my forehead. I counted, and when I opened my eyes, he was gone. I sat up quickly in bed, gasping, my body soaked with sweat. It was pitch dark in the room, not even a sliver of the moon to offer some light. Another nightmare. I'd been having them for almost 2 years, during which they had become more and more violent and vivid, and in each I was hunted by an anonymous man with a knife or a gun. I would struggle to recognize him, but he kept his face turned away from me. Then, just as he'd find my hiding place, I'd wake up with my heart pounding and adrenaline coursing through my legs until they ached. But this nightmare was different. In this dream, I was a young girl again, probably 9 or 10, in my summer pajamas, walking down a long hotel hallway. Suddenly, the elusive man blocked my path, backed me up against the wall, and pointed a gun at my head. I looked up at him, and I finally saw his face. It was a man I hadn't seen since I was a child in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Tony Costa. Tony had been hired as a handyman to fix torn screens and leaky faucets in the Seaside Motel, where my mother worked summers as a housekeeper. Everybody thought Tony was great, especially me. He was part of a revolving door of so-called babysitters my mother corralled to look after me and my younger sister, Louisa. Mom was notorious for being able to find a babysitter faster than she could say the word. She'd stop people in the supermarket or the post office or at the gas pump and ask, "Do you babysit?" Mostly the person would just stare at her, wondering why a mother would hire a random stranger to look after her children with less care than she would a plumber or a car mechanic. But sometimes they said, "Sure." Tony was one of those, and he turned out to be one of the good ones. In fact, he was one of the few kind and gentle adults in my life during those turbulent years. But then in 1969, when I was 10 years old, Tony disappeared. I didn't know why. I just knew he was gone. So why was Tony Costa in my dreams now, holding a gun to my head and smiling with teeth better suited to a wolf? What I remembered about him was all good. In fact, Tony was a nice guy who never yelled, never hit, never made me feel small and ugly and unwanted. I had been afraid of my mother, but never of Tony. So when he suddenly appeared threatening and frightening in my dream, it confounded me. With nowhere else to turn, I did something I learned long ago not to do. I asked Mom for help. I invited her to dinner, and when she arrived at Tim and my house, she was already teetering as she climbed the front porch. She was 70 by then, and everywhere she went, she carried a plastic 16-ounce water bottle of gin stuffed in her purse. "Those were some wild days," she said, seated at my counter and swirling the ice around in her snifter. She was clearly enjoying the memory of those summers on Cape Cod, when she was a pretty divorcee, barely 30 years old, spending most of her free time closing down the various bars and dance clubs with her own revolving door of suitors. She took a long pull on her gin and settled back into her chair while I put the last of the seasoning in the soup simmering on the stove. "Did something happen to me back then that you're not telling me?" I said, suddenly wondering if it had. "What do you mean, happened to you?" "With Tony Costa." "Tony Costa? Why are you still thinking about him?" "Well, I wasn't until I had a nightmare about him." "You and your dreams," she said, snort laughing as she took a sip of her drink. "Well, this one was pretty horrible, but I don't get it. He was always so nice to me," I said. "What do you remember about him?" She was quiet for a moment too long, and I stopped stirring and waited. She was just staring into the bottom of her glass. Mom rarely paused to contemplate her words, so I watched, curious as to what was going to come out of her mouth. "Well," she said, watching the gin swirl around in the glass, "I remember he turned out to be a serial killer." She said it calmly, as if she were reading the weather report. I felt sick. I had always had several disjointed memories about murders that occurred in Provincetown during the years we lived there, but no one ever told me who'd committed them. The bits and pieces I remembered involved hideous crimes, shallow graves, and hearts being carved out of bodies, teeth marks on corpses. I suddenly had an image as clear as the pot of soup on the stove in front of me, of my two little tan feet up on the dashboard of the Royal Coachman's utility truck. Sand was stuck between my toes, and there were flecks of old red nail polish on my big toenails. I loved how tan my feet would get during those long shoeless summers, and with them poised on the dash in front of me, I would turn them this way and that, admiring their smooth brown skin. I was never pretty like my mother, but I thought at least I had her pretty feet. Driving the motel's truck always was Tony Costa. I shook my head to clear the image and turned back to my mother. A serial killer? Tony, the babysitter? "Oh, for Christ's sake," she said, "don't be so dramatic. He wasn't your babysitter." Her eyes narrowed in emphasis. "He was the handyman." I felt as if someone had sucker punched me in the gut. "Handyman at the motel," I said, my words trailing off as I envisioned its long hallway and recognized it from my nightmare. "But Louisa and I went all over the Cape with him," I sputtered. "He took us on errands and out to the dump and out to the Truro Woods. Tony was the Cape Cod vampire? Our Tony? A serial killer?" My words were tumbling out of me. "Yeah, so what?" she said again, reaching for her gin. "He didn't kill you, did he?"
So, Liza, do you think there's a possibility that you saw things that you don't remember, that you've been unable to remember, that are still buried?
I always think there's that possibility. There's something out there that I'm studying up on right now called the unthought known, which is things that you know sort of pre-verbally or pre-memory. So yes, I think there's a possibility. I don't know whether those dreams sort of led me to this book or whether the book led me to the dream. I don't know. and I would hesitate to say yes, but I think there's always a possibility. Those are pretty violent dreams.
Yeah, and
yeah,
maybe
I would share the same thing. I would say, I mean, having been somebody who's been an investigative journalist for years and interviewed thousands of people in those years, there's a reason that Tony came back to her in a nightmare with a gun at her head, mm-hmm. rather than pushing her on the swing, rather than buying her an ice cream. Why, you know, what is in that memory bank that had a not only a darkness around Tony, but a violence around him? So I would, in my pop psychology hat, say that I think absolutely, and I think that perhaps, you know, her own psyche is protecting her from the memory of what she might have seen out in those woods.
Right, because in those days I was more afraid of my mother than I was of Tony. So who knows?
Well, this is a fascinating book. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But we've been talking with Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan about The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Monica. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's been it's really fascinating. It's, you know, it's dark and it's interesting. It's really an interesting story, and I'm glad that you came out the other side of it. So well.
We all. Amen.
Amen. And we close with a quote, and I have a quote today from Natalie Goldberg, who I actually interviewed recently on Writer's Voices. And I think you have done what she recommends, which is write what disturbs you, what you fear, what you have not been willing to speak about. Be willing to be split open.
Yep.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And thank you again, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.